This is Unheard Cuts on Being. I'm Krista Tippett. You're listening to my unedited conversation with Arlene Sanchez-Walsh. She is Associate Professor of Church History and Latino Church Studies at Azusa Pacific University in Azusa, California. I spoke with her on June 22, 2007, from the studios of APM in St. Paul, Minnesota. She was in the studios of public radio station KPCC in Pasadena, California. This interview is included in our show, Reviving Sister Amy. Download the MP3 of the produced show at onbeing.org. Oh, okay. Well, congratulations.
Thank you.
So are you feeling kind of having all-day sickness or just morning?
No, it's the morning.
Mm-hmm.
It's the morning. So I have to be real. I usually have fruit and a piece of bread, very light.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's exciting.
It is. So, it is. Should be fun.
Uh-huh. So when will the baby come?
We're going in September 7th.
Okay. Wow. It's very exciting. Okay, I think... we're ready to go. It's great to talk to you again. I was just listening to the conversation we had out there a year ago,
mm-hmm.
and that was really fun to listen to again. And, you know, what I want to do with this, with an hour on Amy Semple McPherson, is not kind of retrace her biography much as say, you know, why is there this enduring and, in fact, this new interest in her? And what does she tell us about the nature of Pentecostalism? And, you know, what are some of the issues? And I'm interviewing you and Anthea Butler.
Oh, okay.
Okay, sort of. So as two women who are scholars and participants in some sense in this legacy of Amy Semple McPherson. So to try to understand it from the inside and in religious and theological and spiritual terms.
Okay.
And so let's just do that. So even as we talk about her, I want to invite you to say what that means for the present, you know, or what it means for you. I'm really interested also because you worship at a four-square church, and so you really are directly in that lineage.
That's true.
So, but just to start, you actually weren't raised Pentecostal.
I wasn't. I was born and raised Catholic,
mm-hmm.
and I converted in 1985, and I found my way through working at a community college to interviewing a pastor of a four-square church right down the block here from the radio station.
Uh-huh.
And he, in very Pentecostal fashion, said, well, I'll help you with your work, but that's not why you're here. I said, well, what do you mean? Well, you're really here to reconnect with God, but you're not going to know that for a few years, but that's okay.
Really?
Yeah. And I automatically thought, oh, this is what I've been reading about, but never mind.
All right.
It was a couple of years later that I figured out that he was correct. Whether it was a hunch, whether it was prophetic, I'll leave that up to people to decide. But it was very unusual. And I ended up worshiping, and I still worship at that church.
At the same church?
Yeah.
So when do you recall when and how you first heard about Amy Semple McPherson? Was it as a scholar, or was it as a worshiper in the Foursquare tradition?
It was as an undergrad. American religious history. She was one of a staple of eccentric religious figures that we kind of bypassed on our way through more serious people. She was put in the same cast as televangelists.
Mm-hmm.
And so whenever they would cast her, in terms of, well, we have some precursors to people like Falwell and Robertson and the religious right, their sister Amy, and they focus on her flamboyancy and, of course, the controversy surrounding her kidnapping. And then we just dropped it. And I didn't hear anything else about her until I joined Foursquare.
Hmm. And then what did you hear about her?
Well, and then I heard the almost complete opposite. She was this wonderful woman, spirit-filled, pioneer, had some problems, very generic about what the quote-unquote problems were. But they venerated her, and they still do. And one of the more interesting things I remember early on as I was deciding about whether to become Foursquare or not was I took a tour of Angelus Temple with some very nice older women who wanted to show me the healing rooms and the crutches and the wheelchairs that people had left and wanted to promote the proper legacy of right. Sister Amy, I guess. Mm-hmm. And then we went to visit her grave at Forest Lawn. And the prayer, we prayed at her grave. And one of the people at this tour mentioned that, well, we can focus on the negative, but we'd rather focus on the positive. So the four-square spin, generally, in my opinion, has been to focus on the positive, mm-hmm. on the fact that she founded a movement. They have tended, I don't think they discount the controversies, but they tend not to want to focus on those. So I've heard two different, very different variations of who she was.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I think this is a question I thought I might ask at the end, but actually I think it lends itself right here. So, I mean, the first interpretation you mentioned that you got in a college class of her as being a predecessor of these early televangelists, or of televangelists, or of people like Falwell and Robertson. I mean, that's also kind of the conclusion that you got from a recent PBS documentary about Amy Semple McPherson. But how do you, so is that how you think about her as a predecessor to these kinds of figures in our current life?
No, I don't think that that's all there is to her. In really reading about her and thinking about her more, I think she represents kind of a religious innovator, but also someone who has all these different conflicts, and she's just very, very human. Mm-hmm. At the same time that she's very ecumenical, she can be very nativist and anti-Catholic. At the same time that she tries to be interracial, she can be bitterly anti-Mexican, depending on what suits her needs for the time. Also, just her loneliness and her depression and her all the things that kind of made her very human. That's what attracts me to Amy.
That's it's what attracts so you much, to her.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, because she's real. You know, there are some religious figures whose personal life have been laid open this broadly before mm-hmm. the public. But generally, it's viewed as a negative. It's viewed as something that was overcome, that God in his grace has seen beyond that. But her as a woman, as a single mother, as divorced, mm-hmm. as someone who kind of exuded this quiet sexuality when women just were not supposed to be sexual, unless they were a different type of woman,
mm-hmm.
it was very unique. Very unique. And so I'm attracted to her humanness more than what she represents as a political or a media figure.
Okay. Well, let's talk about her as a spiritual figure, as a player in those early years of the Pentecostal movement. You have talked about what you see as a real creative energy in the early decades mm-hmm. of the Pentecostal movement. How do you see Amy Semple McPherson figuring in that picture?
Well, I think the boldness to just harness on this theological message of Pentecostalism onto mass media,
mm-hmm.
and since that has been like kind of the number one theme of people who study her, to study her in that realm, that is certainly true. There's nobody, the illustrated sermon you think about today, the kind of over-the-top evangelical message of harnessing everything to media, she is really a precursor to all of that. That is true.
She was the first woman, not just the first religious broadcaster, the first woman to get a license with the FCC to start her radio station.
Uh-huh. Yes, extremely bold and extremely interesting in the way she would just be very brash about seeking publicity.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it just was, it seemed to be very un-evangelical. You know, if you're talking about this kind of evangelical gentility, that women were supposed to, even today, women are supposed to kind of border themselves in with this genteel idea of who they are.
Mm-hmm.
She just wouldn't have any of that. And so I find that to be very exciting.
Mm-hmm. And what else? I mean, there is that. That jumps out at people. What else do you see?
I think also the fact that she managed to marry social concern and Pentecostalism mm-hmm. early on in her mission, because she, as you know, come out of the Salvation Army.
Yeah.
The ability to wed those two things is something that I view Pentecostalism is at its best when it realizes that it's not really in the center of American Christianity. It really operates best at the margins, and it operates best because that's who populates these churches by and large. I think the kind of theme that says, you know, she brought Pentecostalism into the mainstream, she did that through media.
Right.
But I wonder what has been lost because she brought it to the mainstream. And so I kind of lament what was lost.
So that's part of so that's part of her legacy for you that is troubling.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, because I think...
which is interesting because I think for outside scholars, that might be one of the parts of her legacy that's most impressive.
Yeah, well, because it makes sense to bring this, what I guess outside scholars want to see as a very marginal, poor group into the mainstream. But in doing so, in her chapters in her life, she just became miserable, you know, and she became much more of a Hollywood political institution in Los Angeles than during the Depression, where she said, you know, true Christianity is about not only to be good, but to do good. And so that is the message that she inherited from the Salvation Army that I wish more Pentecostals would adhere to today.
And from your perspective as a scholar, I mean, one of your emphases as a scholar has been on Latino Pentecostals. It seems to me that she carried forward some interesting strands of those earliest days of Pentecostalism that started to get lost pretty quickly as, you know, and I'm talking about first of all, she was in Los Angeles still in this multi-ethnic place when she finally founded Angelus Temple. But that the multiracial, I mean, as you're saying, she did bring it into the mainstream, but her doors, at least from what I've read, seem to always have been open to everyone, to people of any creed and class. And that was not carried forward, even by some of the earliest, the other earliest denominations of Pentecostalism. Is that right?
That is true. That is true. She often... her doors were open. It was an interracial place. You would get reports of things in the magazine, and other outside observers at Angelus Temple said that they couldn't believe how multicultural it was.
Mm-hmm.
And for 1920s, 1930s Los Angeles, that's quite shocking. I go back to what I mentioned is that with all of these figures, especially with Amy, since she made it such a prominent part of her theological outreach, was that she couldn't quite temper the tenor of the times, which was really to be anti-minority.
Mm-hmm. And how did that manifest itself?
I guess one of the prime examples would be when she was kidnapped.
Right.
And in her kidnapping, she was very, this could be attributed to just wanting to fight back against anyone who claimed not to believe her story. But the Mexican officials in particular said, we doubt any of this actually occurred. And in her...
because she turned up again in Mexico.
She turned up again.
Right?
That's right.
Mm-hmm.
And her response to that said, well, it's very, very funny that you would actually start believing a Mexican right now.
Really?
So, yeah. it's that internal tension of I guess, having a heart turned around for people and wanting to do outreach for everyone. But at the same time, when it comes to push and shove and basically having your empire at stake... to relying on stereotypes and things like that. And there are other examples I could get into. But, I mean, essentially, that's part of the legacy. And Foursquare, like the Assemblies of God and like many other early Pentecostal, classical Pentecostal denominations, they kind of abandoned that interracial harmony or that kind of golden era post Azusa Street fairly quickly. And it wasn't up until, I want to say, 5 or 6 years ago that Latinos in Foursquare had any... autonomy with their own supervisors. So for several decades, they were under Anglo supervision, without a voice.
Really?
Of someone who would speak for their concerns. That's correct.
Now, what kind of surprises me about this too is that you know, another story that I've read that recurs is how critical she was, especially in, as I've heard someone say, you know, keeping the Mexican community alive during the Depression with the program she set up to feed people.
Oh, that's absolutely true.
Uh-huh.
Her soup kitchens, and I guess you've heard the Anthony Quinn stories.
Yes.
About, yeah,
he's he used to translate her into Spanish when she preaching in Los Angeles. Right.
And the Pentecostal church that she set up in Los Angeles is the largest Pentecostal church in L.A. at the time, Mission Mexicana McPherson, you know, which is the Mexican mission McPherson.
Right.
And so these are crucial and critical areas for social concern, definitely for Mexicans who were about to be repatriated during that time from the Depression. I guess what would have been radical was for her to speak out more on these type of issues. Mm-hmm. Now, certainly the soup kitchens, the clothing and things like that, very critical, but the repatriation still happened. and Mexicans who were taken off the welfare rolls in L.A. County were sent back, whether they were citizens or not. But I guess it would be, asking too much to kind of rewrite the history and have her speak out on that.
Would she have had that power, I guess, although she had so much
power? She had power to talk
about. Right.
Yeah, well, that's the thing, is just she had a lot of political power to speak out against evolution, to speak for the progressive era of Los Angeles, all these progressive politicians in that era, that time. And later on, obviously, with the kind of this crusade to bring America back to its quote-unquote Christian foundation. Mm-hmm. She certainly had the ear of a lot of politicians, but like I said, I think it would have been asking a little too much. But certainly I don't want to discount her her crucial importance during the Depression era for Mexicans in L.A.
Mm-hmm. And then there is this legacy which you can't just attribute to her, but which is part of the fact that this Pentecostal movement that started in Los Angeles just 100 years ago spread around the world. I mean, the Foursquare Church alone, I've read, has 50,000 churches, 5 million members in 147 countries. the Pope recently, in 2007, had to reckon, went to Latin America to reckon with how incredibly powerful Pentecostal spirituality has been converting Roman Catholics. So many Roman Catholics have converted. And I just wanted to ask you about that because you are also part of that story and you're helping to tell that story as a scholar. So, you know, how would you talk to somebody about that as a part of, you know, what Aimee Semple McPherson was kind of bringing into the world?
I think the idea of mission, the idea of it's not just here that you do your church, but you are equipped, and they always talk in that language, you are equipped to go out to spread this message around the world, starts at the beginning and it keeps going. There are constant appeals to mission even today. Foursquare is 5-10 times larger around the world than it is in the United States. And as a matter of fact, probably like many other classical Pentecostal denominations, in the global Foursquare movement, it's growing. In the U.S. market, it is declining or stagnating. Mm-hmm. So that's very typical. It's typical of the Assemblies of God and probably a couple of other Pentecostal denominations. That need to go out, you know, the whole Great Commission idea, that theological anchor is so strong in this movement that you will give more to missions if you're a small little church than you will give to support kind of any local initiative. Mm-hmm. And that's definitely a part of her legacy, and that's part of Azusa Street. But this kind of like 25-year Pentecostal outburst, if you will, in Los Angeles is that
you mean after 1906 Azusa Street?
Yeah, it's got to go out, and so you see just a barrage of activity throughout the world. Foursquare starts a lot in Central South America. I think Panama is its first. Yeah, Panama is its first outpost.
Wasn't one of the earliest missions from one of the earliest converts also going to Mexico?
Yeah. So that's it's crucial to understand this movement as one that sends out and that keeps doing it, and that you know personally we are constantly asked to give money to this to support it because it's still part of the mission. It's still part of what we do, which is to support churches and missions around the world.
But here's what I'd like to get at as well. I think I was interested in the press reporting around the Pope's trip to Latin America, which was, which is very explicitly in part about kind of reaching out to that Roman Catholic base, which seems to be, which is being eroded mostly by Pentecostal spirituality. What I don't think journalists knew how to describe or even explain was, what is that appeal? You know, what is it that is eroding that base, that is drawing people into this world? I mean, you're talking about the mission, but what is it that is happening then that they take out there?
Okay, I think there's about three things that are happening. One of them is that Pentecostalism is kind of an unvarnished, if you will, spirituality. It's embodied. It is highly personal and very intense. And so for people who are used to a kind of hierarchical, traditional liturgical religion, this kind of breaks all boundaries because you don't have mediators anymore. You don't have
priests.
You don't have priests.
Or
you don't necessarily even have sacraments.
Uh-huh.
You just have you and God, and God can work those same miracles that they know about in terms of healing, in terms of other miracles that they that people are used to praying through saints or through Mary for, that they can occur immediately in one's life. So I think the immediacy, the immediate experiential nature of Pentecostalism is it's just a powerful magnet for people. And it kind of breaks with convention. It breaks with tradition. You don't really have to go through anything to get to it. Secondly, I think, is that there's a very kind of simple, but that Pentecostal churches, aside from the large mega churches, many of which are in Latin America, they're small. So there's an intimacy. Priests in an average church in Mexico City or other parts of Latin America, there's thousands of people going to Mass. There are 7 to 10 Masses every Sunday. And so there's an anonymity that you have just sitting there, being a part of a mm-hmm. like large congregation. In a Pentecostal church in the outskirts of Mexico City where there's like 75 people, or even in East L.A. where there's about 50 people, there's an immediacy in that you know your pastor, and the chances are your pastor's just like you. They're probably bivocational. They are probably not seminary educated. And so there's something about the tangibility of reaching out to someone who's just like you that makes it more attractive.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess thirdly is that this idea that, going back to the immediacy again, is that Latinos have a sense of empowerment, that they have now taken control of their spirituality. It isn't part of a hierarchical church function. It's me. And I can do with it what I will. So if I want to pray, I can do that. If I want to help out, I can do that. There are more places for me to help out. If I want to become a part of, quote unquote, the priesthood of all believers, if I want to do that, I can do it immediately.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't need to wait for training. I don't need to wait for church sanction. I can do it now. And so I think finding a place for Latinos to be who they are, spiritually and otherwise, kind of harness all those things together, and that creates a very exciting picture.
And in Latin America, as elsewhere in the globe, and as you described in Los Angeles, in the United States, mm-hmm. in the earliest years of Pentecostalism, that empowering message, those empowering messages were coming to people on the margins of society who had no power.
That's right. That's right. I mean, if you can imagine telling someone for the first time who has no health care, who has very little education, who lives on the margins, who is maybe possibly an undocumented person, that if they pray, and they pray right now, God can heal them. That is such an intensely powerful statement to someone on the margins that if they pray, something will happen. The flip side to that, obviously, and I don't know if, and I know this is a part of Latin American Pentecostalism, is that prayer and the power of healing and the power of the dynamism of God's interaction with people has now taken on this different turn of God's reciprocity, meaning that, well, if you pray and if you do these certain things, God will not only bless you with health, but he will bless you with abundance,
mm-hmm.
with prosperity.
Mm-hmm.
That is also another part of that Latin American message that is catching fire, which shouldn't be discounted when we think about how global Pentecostalism is growing. It's predominantly growing because of its healing nature
mm-hmm.
and because of its ability to soothe your material needs.
Hmm. Although, I mean, and I don't know if you're imagining this as well, but my understanding also in Latin America is that this empowerment of Pentecostalism allows people, not so much in terms of the prosperity gospel, but just to get on their feet economically, that it helps people overcome addiction, stabilize their family lives, and there's that kind of economic stability sometimes that follows.
That's right. The converts in a couple of different countries, Guatemala that I'm aware of, and Colombia, for example, there's been research done that sociologists, anthropologists have done that have followed families for about 5 years after conversion and noticed how much money has come into the family, how it is stabilizing
mm-hmm.
social mobility. They don't drink anymore. They don't do other things that are viewed as vices anymore. And so it in a very tangible way is helping them to rise up out of the very poor classes into kind of a middle class status. So in a sense, it's kind of doing that Calvinist Weberian thing of moving people into the middle class in a very strange way.
Yeah, in the Protestant spirit of capitalism. Yes,
that's right. That's right. It's kind of doing that.
Mm-hmm. And something else we should mention, especially since the larger context of this conversation is Aimee Semple McPherson, is that women are some of those, have been some of those marginalized people, that also women in Guatemala who have had no social standing are hearing that God can speak directly to them, that they can control their destiny, that they can be healed through prayer. And so it almost seems to me, and this is true globally as well, that, that there are many stories of how empowering Pentecostal Christianity is for women. That in some ways, this legacy of Aimee Semple McPherson, a strong woman who heard the voice of God and followed and thought big and dreamed big and organized, that part of her legacy is being picked up in the present in faraway places in ways that it may not be mirrored in this culture.
Well, I've talked to several Foursquare women who are so inspired by the notion of Sister Aimee, and these are Latina women, who know that in their home countries, they're mostly immigrant, know in their home countries they would not have a voice in Guatemala and in other places, in Argentina. But when they immigrate to the United States, they hear this story, and they just become excited about the idea that even if they were once divorced, even if they have their own marital problems, even if they're not the best person, they have a dream. They have a dream of wanting to preach. They want to open a church. They want to be in charge. You know, they are not satisfied with being kind of the handmaiden of their pastor husband. They want to do something independently. I think the spirit of independence is a very attractive to Latina women, many of whom have that glass ceiling in almost all denominations, evangelical or otherwise, who cannot break beyond that glass ceiling of being a senior pastor or being someone who can actually preach aside from teaching. There's all these kind of semantic games people play with what women are actually doing.
Right.
But there's no question that in Pentecostal churches, women, who are more than half of the congregation, prophesy, preach, teach, and they do things that would be viewed as unseemly or theologically unorthodox, that they in other settings, in other theological settings, and I think that's just a powerful, it's a powerful message. Now, the issue is, do women recognize that that's liberation? Do they recognize that that is a liberating presence?
What do you mean by that?
Well, I think very often scholars, especially North American feminist scholars, want to see Latina women, Pentecostal women, as still being very oppressed because they're not in the central corridor of power. And my argument has always been, well, they have a different notion of power. Power for Latina women tends to be located in the family. Mm-hmm. It tends to be located in these auxiliary forms of power, which is, I may not be running a senior church and I don't have the purse strings to buy all the equipment I want for church and the furniture and the hymnals, etc. But I can preach and teach, and I can live my life fairly clear of any type of interference from people. And for me, that's empowering. And my family, my husband no longer drinks. You know, my son who was in gangs is no longer in a gang. So there's these other forms of empowerment that I think North American feminists, especially feminist scholars of religion, need to acknowledge. And I think they are. They're coming to see alternate forms of power as equally as liberating and as empowering.
So what is the role of women in the women in ministry in the current Foursquare Church, the denomination that Aimee Semple McPherson founded? My sense is that women are not as present and powerful as one might assume with that kind of female founding figure.
Well, you'd be correct. Most of the, for example, the executive council and the people who run Foursquare are men. I think there's one woman, and I don't know that she has a central figure. She's not a central role player. She is someone who's on the board. There are, as I can tell, I don't see any superintendents in California anyway that are women. I would doubt very much that nationally that number would change very much. There might be one or two somewhere out in the country, but I haven't seen them. If they're there, they're new. Generally, when you speak of superintendents or people who are in charge of certain districts in Foursquare, it tends to be a male pastor, and then they kind of bracket in parentheses the wife.
Right.
So it could
right.
be somebody, and then it's the wife. They're very much like other classical Pentecostal denominations. Women are usually given churches that are very small to be senior pastors, or they're given churches that are in trouble, meaning that they're so small in that they're kind of given this kind of, unfortunately, this kind of hopeless case where they have no money, they have no staff, they have really no congregation, and they're put there to kind of build it back up. Or they're given specialized ministries, children, mm-hmm. family, mm-hmm. Assistance to physically challenged, kind of deaf ministries. It plays on very well, whether one likes it or not, with the whole idea of what women are good at,
okay.
nurturing.
Mm-hmm.
And we may disagree with that, but that tends to be the Foursquare model.
So how do you explain that?
I think Foursquare, in large part, and especially in the United States, has become pretty much generically evangelical. And so it's kind of harnessed itself onto a message of a very conservative theological message. Essentially, it's like evangelical with a sprinkling of Pentecostal spirituality.
Right. And, you know, I think you need to explain that for people who are listening, because journalists and sure. our culture tends to conflate these terms, Pentecostal and evangelical.
Right.
But I've heard you say this before, and I've heard
yeah.
others say this within the Pentecostal movement, that Pentecostalism has lost a lot of its early distinctives, which included an incredible empowerment of women and mm-hmm. Theologies of social justice and pacifism, that those things have receded as Pentecostals have become more mainstream, which has meant becoming less Pentecostal in that original sense and more evangelical, which in your mind is in fact, historically, a very different way of being Christian.
Yes, well, for me, it is. And historically, I think it can be argued that it's radically different.
Mm-hmm.
What evangelicalism to me means kind of a word-based, meaning word, meaning the Bible, a Bible-based kind of propositional faith that focuses on proving Christianity true and kind of has historically sets up seminaries and other institutes like that to prove itself, to be an apologetic engine. To prove the truth of various claims of Christianity. And it also, for whatever reason, tends to be very rooted in very conservative politics and a very conservative literalist reading of the Bible, which women should be silent and women do not have authority and things of that nature. And also focuses exclusively in terms of quote-unquote evangelism on conversion. And so evangelism mm-hmm. has one way to be viewed here. And so it means conversion. It doesn't necessarily mean social concern.
Okay.
And it almost never does. So this kind of divorcing of evangelicalism and Pentecostalism, I think the two have merged. And so as Pentecostalism, you said
so
it
what
correctly.
Is the contrast kind of, for you? I mean, what so in contrast to word-based institution-based, conservative,
yeah.
socially conservative. What is Pentecostalism to you?
Pentecostalism to me is spirit-driven. It is something that moves in people's hearts, if you will, and it is actualized by God speaking to you about certain things, and you reacting in that way. You reacting towards someone who is feeling poorly about themselves, you're reacting to the social concern you see around you, not divorcing social concern and evangelism, and certainly opening one's eyes more to seeing evangelism as simply not just conversion. And I think that's been a huge problem that I see personally, is that just if that's all it is, then beyond the initial conversion, how do you take care of people? How do you discipline? How do you disciple people? How do you move people into a greater relationship with God if all you're concerned with is whether
okay.
they ever make a statement of faith?
Okay. Yeah, and I interrupted you. You were going to say that
that
Pentecostals, that there's been this merger, I think that's what you were starting to say. That
Yeah, well, that I don't see most Pentecostalism, especially Enforcer, which is the one that I know best, mm-hmm. being any different than generic evangelicalism. Essentially, what I see happening is that they took certain messages from evangelicalism that suit their needs, you know. And so, if you want to remove women from the prophetic priestly role, you start emphasizing those passages that say women should not preach, women should not have any say. Essentially, that women should not be an authority above men. And so those things are taught. The focus is on marriage and family and nurture are taught. So those things take precedent mm-hmm. over any of the liberative early engine that Amy started in terms of her independence, her spirituality, and her function really as a pioneer of this movement.
I have read that. I mean, my sense is that she was not very concerned with theology. I mean, clearly she had a theological basis. She was a preacher. She was an organizer. But she did grapple with, she had those Bible verses thrown at her about women staying silent.
Right.
And she did kind of look at all the different kinds of messages there are about women in Scripture, and she found her own ministry validated by statements such as, in Christ there is neither Jew nor Greek, male nor female, slave nor free. I mean, she did find what she was doing also to have its basis in the Bible and find that other kind of witness that speaks counter to some of those interpretations you described.
Probably more powerful than that, and I don't discount that, is the Joel passage where your sons and daughters shall prophesy.
Right.
And
right.
So if that's our anchor text, aside from all the stuff in Acts, which is almost everything, but then it's hard to discount that. It's hard to discount if women can prophesy, then what do we do with that?
Mm-hmm.
If the Spirit falls on all flesh, then what do we do not only with women but with people who are not Christian if the Spirit is falling on all flesh? Those are theological questions that I think Pentecostalism has wrestled with women for a while, and it's still wrestling with women.
Right.
I think Pentecostalism theologically needs to wrestle with the rest of it, with the rest of what that statement means, because it's a radical statement, and it will. It'll take a generation or so, but it will.
And that may be a kind of challenge that the 21st century makes inevitable in a way the 20th may not have.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. Amos Young has been doing some work on that, hasn't he? Have
you? Yes, he has.
Yes, he has.
He's a Pentecostal theologian who really brought it to the forefront with his book. And I think it's one of those things we have to argue with. It's living in a pluralistic reality, and to some extent, for many, not liking it, but not knowing what to do about it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And how you live in that tension, not so much how you change it, you know, mm-hmm. because it's debatable whether you can change it at all, but how you live in it. So I think all these complicating questions of gender, of race, of pluralism, they will all be fleshed out. Maybe not, hopefully better than the first century of American Pentecostalism, but we'll have to see.
I think that is an interesting point, though, that Pentecostalism by its very nature may be in a position to wrestle with those kinds of questions creatively and expansively, in a way that it may be harder for evangelical Christianity to kind of take on.
Yes, because of its history and because of where it's placed in the world, because it has to wrestle with pluralism if it's in Africa, if it's in Latin America to a certain extent, with Catholicism, obviously, and if it's in Asia. It has to wrestle with gender. It has to wrestle with race. It has to wrestle with all these big questions, and it is placed better. It just... Does it have the capacity to? Does it have the theological capacity to ask these questions? That's a question that I haven't had answered yet.
Mm-hmm. I wonder, let's talk about other aspects of Latino Pentecostalism presently, or projects that you know about, where you see the legacy of Emmy Semple McPherson, or strains of early Pentecostalism she represented, kind of still at work and evolving. And I'm thinking of, for example, the notion of healing. And I think that's something you talk about a lot as part of really vibrant ministries in the world now.
I think that's a really important part of the reach of global Pentecostalism. I think an interesting study that came out a few months ago from Pew mentioned that 49% of Pentecostals, as they call them, renewalists, which is Pentecostal slash charismatic, but 49% report never speaking in tongues, which is quite astonishing considering so many of these denominations live or die based on that statement,
right,
in their fundamental truths. But that a predominant 60% believe that the most important part of Pentecostalism is healing. And in terms of Latino Pentecostalism,
rather than speaking in tongues.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, if almost half never speak in tongues,
right,
it would lead you to believe that it's not even important.
Yeah. Yeah.
That what's important is that my testimony to you now is healing. My testimony to you isn't speaking in tongues, because that is such a, you know, viewed as such an unusual practice, and it is wholly, you know, individualized. It's got to happen to you first, and the only way you can well yourself up enough to kind of make it a public gift is if you prophesy in public that way.
Mm-hmm.
That is a very hard thing for people to do. But healing comes to anyone. I believe speaking in tongues is easier to compartmentalize. You can kind of shut it off to the side. You can have people do it quietly. You can kind of hide it. Healing is hard to hide. If it happens, it happens. It's much easier to pray for healing than to pray for people to be filled with the Spirit to speak in tongues. They're two very radically different manifestations. For Latinos, I don't think healing has ever really stopped. I mean, one of the things that I've been looking at is that how ethnic churches, not just Latino, but Asian, African, African-American, other racial churches, rather, how they seem to maintain a more heightened sense of Pentecostal spirituality than Anglo churches. If you go to a typical Anglo-Pentecostal church in the United States, for example, it seems, again, to be fairly generically evangelical. There's not a lot of prophecy or tongues, et cetera. But if you go to an ethnic church or a racial church, there's a lot of that. There's always prayer for healing.
So how do you explain that difference?
Well, I'm trying to get my mind around it as well. I think it's because ethnic churches are still very much rooted in the essentials of Pentecostalism.
Hmm.
Why did I become this? Why did I give up whatever I gave up, whether it be Catholicism or anything else? Why did I become this way? It's because God did something tremendous. God did something extraordinary. So I can't really give that up. And so a lot of these are first-generation Pentecostal. So it's that whole idea of the kind of zealousness of early converts. Whereas if you go to a church that has kind of routinized in mm-hmm. its spirituality, it's just less likely. Either that or it's more compartmentalized. You know, you can do it on Wednesday when there's not that many people around. If you want to, you can pray. You can pray for healing. But we want to keep that on Wednesday. It's also been this move towards becoming more generically evangelical with Pentecostals is to want to be more seeker-sensitive, to want to not have to explain these
to
manifestations.
To not be in your face.
to not scare visitors.
By speaking in tongues.
Yes.
Okay.
By not falling on the floor.
Yeah. Right. Now, and I also think that when you talk about healing, and maybe this is a way, for example, that our culture evolves and Pentecostalism evolves. I mean, Amy Semple McPherson was part of that generation where healing meant somebody walked in a wheelchair and was supposed to stand up and walk out on their two legs, right? It was that kind of public, that physical healing.
Yes.
But when I hear you talk about it and other people talk about healing in the Pentecostal church, and especially among people on the margins, it's inner work, right, as much as physical work.
That is absolutely true. I think what we've seen since Amy, if you want to look at like the last 60 years of Pentecostalism, is this idea that healing takes on many manifestations and many forms. There's kind of the psychological healing. There's emotional healing. There's still physical healing, but it seemed to be as equitable when somebody's giving a testimony to say, well, I just want you to know that I came through this very bad divorce and God's healed me of those emotions because it was very hurtful. That is on par with somebody coming in and saying, you know, I had a bad diagnosis with something. God healed me. I have the x-ray. Here it is.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so I hear more about emotional and psychological healing than I do about physical healing. And I don't know where that's come from other than this is a much more therapeutic society.
Yeah,
and so I think that that's played a large part of it, and you know what, those are inner workings exactly as you said, and it's harder to verify.
Right.
It's just harder. It's
right.
It's harder. It's a, you know, if somebody gets out of a wheelchair, or somebody shows you an X-ray, you're going, wow, that's empirical.
Mm-hmm.
But if somebody says, well, I've just come through a really bad divorce, and I, it's the therapeutic language sounds very much like someone who's just come out of counseling.
Right.
And so you don't want to discount it, but you want to say, well, that's great. I'm so glad that God healed you that way. But we've lost sense of that other physical healing. So I think physical healing has receded in terms of its testimony, which you hear a lot more now in churches are the therapeutic, the emotional, the psychological.
And yet, I mean, you've written about Pentecostal groups and projects. What's mm-hmm. the one I didn't write this down, but
Victory Outreach.
Victory Outreach, for example.
Yeah.
Which is about being there for people who are wounded in every conceivable way.
That's correct.
In our society, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes. Well, it's an anti-drug ministry, anti-gang ministry. And so they are still very much rooted in the classical Pentecostal form, meaning that one day you're a heroin addict, they'll lay hands on you, pray for you. The next day, you don't want any more heroin.
And you've heard those stories? You've seen them?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, mm-hmm. dramatically. Almost everyone I ever talked to had some kind of drug issue or dependency issue in terms of they even talk that way in terms of women will talk that way very much in terms of abusive relationships. They couldn't get out of it. They kept going home. They kept getting beat up. And then God told them that this is the last time you're going back home. You are now free from this. And they had some kind of inner strength to stop that behavior, and they went to a shelter for the first time. They stood up for the first time. So it's all this therapeutic enmeshed with the physical, because these are people with multiple levels.
Right.
Of,
I mean, this is where the physical and the spiritual and the emotional are not distinguishable
exactly.
anymore.
That's right. That's right. So that's very active, very thriving. And then I think it's obviously because they're in the margins. These are people who don't have thousands of dollars to go to a camp. You know, to go to drug rehab,
right?
You know, and they're not animated towards going to 12-step example. And some of them have come out of 12-step. I don't want to discount that, but mm-hmm. this immediacy, intermeshed with the theological certainty that God is working, again forms a very powerful message to people. Many of whom, if I remember correctly, did not have much of a background. They were nominally Catholic, nominally something else, nominally. They were very nominal. So they didn't have strong ties to begin with. But when you offer them something of certainty and something that is experientially so powerful, it says now you can actually be free of your addiction. It's really a very powerful message, and that's predominantly the reason why that movement has grown.
And I mean, you know, I'm sure that someone would listen to you and just be very skeptical. And I will say that as a journalist who's looked at this, I mean, there are so many. This is something that is said of Pentecostalism globally, that it does seem to have this, that there is this remarkable body of testimony, let's say, and I think some evidence in there too. I mean, that people have studied of to where people emerge from addiction, mm-hmm. who maybe could not find help any other way. You know, and those stories are kind of, you know, those stories are so dramatic. And, you know, and I was actually thinking about this as I was preparing to interview you and thinking mm-hmm. about Amy Semple McPherson and how people sometimes write off her seriousness by saying, well, it was all about showmanship. It was all about the drama and the stage. And then it occurred to me that that there's something that happens, that Pentecostal experience, maybe at its best or at its most dramatic, is kind of larger than life, and that there's something magnetic about that, that transformative experience, that there's mm-hmm. a way in which even that her flamboyance kind of was a strange worldly reflection. I'm kind of grasping for words, but I was really struck by this as I was preparing.
Right. I don't know. I don't know other realms of life where people normally make claims like this.
No.
You can think about it. If you can think about kind of the ordinary things of your day, you know, if you've actually come in, if you encounter something like this, how extraordinary it would be, you know, but yeah. how unusual. And usually, obviously, our first reaction is to say, well, there's a good explanation for it.
Right.
there's got to be something. And
some rational explanation.
Yeah, there's a rational explanation. Yeah. And I think also, too, is that that's Pentecostalism's great genius, is to say, well, it really isn't about explaining it. It's about experiencing it. And if you can at some point understand what it's like to get inside these experiences, that's really the only way to counter skepticism. And my obviously my point is not to counter all skepticism, because I've also seen the other side of all these things too. So it's very unusual to be a participant observer in these things, to kind of to see the things that you know are kind of odd.
To see people to see being healed that, or to...
To see things that, to see people being healed, to see, to hear prophecy, but particularly healing, because that's kind of an empirical thing you can't really discount. To see X-rays of stuff like that, and to hear people talk about it with a certainty as if it's a concrete reality. And so I do in my writing is I try to let people speak for themselves, because I've kind of dispensed with the idea that I can prove or disprove anything. That's not what I'm in the business of doing, I guess. I think I want to let people speak for themselves, particularly people of color, because I think there's some agency, some religious agency and empowerment that comes from telling your own story, free of the lens of any kind of preset theological notion that it's impossible, it can't happen. It's, you know, there's wish fulfillment. There's all these other, there's all kinds of theories as to how this cannot happen. But to let them kind of speak for themselves and say, well, I'm just telling you this is what happened. And I can be quite as incredulous as anybody else, but my purpose is to let them speak for themselves, because I think the power of testimony, the power of creating your own kind of spiritual life story, that in and of itself is something that I think we have to consider in terms of how these testimonies affect others. You know, forgetting the fact that whether it's true or not, you know, because true is one of these empirical categories that's very tough to get around.
Yeah.
But what does it do to other people to hear this in an informal setting at a house with friends or in a formal setting at church? It shakes you, you know, into some kind of sense of, I'm so glad I'm a part of this because I know it works. It validates you.
That's fascinating. That's a fascinating observation. And I have to say, you know, my producers and I came to the Azusa Street Centennial. I saw you there in early in April. Was it April? Yeah, April
of
2006.
Right.
And there is, I mean, just the feeling being in those spaces where Pentecostals are gathered together and singing together and praying together. I mean, that's what I was thinking of when I was reading about the Pope in Latin America. And very clear that he couldn't understand what it was that was drawing people. And he was making kind of rational doctrinal arguments. And I knew that what he was up against was, in a human sense, so magnetic for reasons that you couldn't throw. You could throw all the facts and rationality and doctrine in the world at it. I mean, I probably shouldn't be saying this, but...
No, I think you're right. I think that's part of its... Well, early on with Sister Amy, when people were trying to discount her, when fundamentalists, that whole fundamentalist modernist thing, when fundamentalists said, this is impossible. She's a shyster, essentially. You know, she's just out to get money. She's a showman, whatever. It's this kind of rational, propositional idea that says that, no, we know what it says. We know what the word says. We know what God is capable of. And this is what God wants us to do. Pentecostalism, because of its spirit-led, spirit-driven, spirit-formed reality, says, you know what, well, we know that too, but God takes us in different ways, and sometimes we just can't explain it. We have no idea. I mean, and so you hear these countless stories of how God touches people, and it's powerful. I mean, I know we have said that often and often again, but I don't know how else to describe it other than to get inside these experiences and to understand that there's no possible way you could have known this. You could have felt this way. You could have had an understanding about people's situation. Or you could have been healed of this if it weren't for something transcendent. You know, your rational mind cannot get around why this is happening. And so that, because this, I think we are people in search of a mystery. We're in search of some kind of transcendence. It offers us something finally, positive or not. I mean, if, you know, for me it's positive, but I mean, for others it's not. To say, you know, yeah, I can get my mind around this some way, you know. And if not my mind, I know that I can be led toward it somehow. And I don't necessarily have to be explained. And the power of it is not to be explained. The power of it is to be experienced.
And then I think there's also an argument for outsiders, journalists, policymakers, leaders to to learn to take that seriously in the sense that it is forming so many people around the globe, right? It's
that's
maybe
right.
Half a billion people.
Yeah, that's what the latest count is. I think that's really important, is to understand that this is just as legitimate. You know, if we are living, and we definitely are in this pluralistic world, which is very difficult to comprehend and explain, and how do people get along in Africa, Pentecostals, Muslims, Anglicans, et cetera, how do people do this, is to really understand the legitimacy of all these worldviews. As messy as they are, as difficult and as competing as they are for the hearts and souls of people, mm-hmm. is that to understand that this is one of these things that really people gravitate towards.
Yeah.
You know, and it's not rational, and it's not strictly a materialist sense of, you know, it helps people get back on their feet. It does, to a certain extent. But it starts with kind of this wholly individualistic, intensely private feeling. That
whole body nobody experience, has, yes.
Yeah, mm-hmm. yeah, and I think that's a really important to kind of see through journalistic eyes, through policymakers' eyes, that this is a legitimate movement, and to use those older arguments of, well, it's just the disinherited, they're looking for something, they can't find it, whatever type of arguments that people use, that we need a new language to describe what's going on here, that mm-hmm. all those other arguments, in my opinion, have not been validated with any type of historical, sociological proof.
Hmm.
So we're looking at something that needs to be used. You need to use a new language to describe what's going on here, other than these are just poor masses of disinherited people who can't find anything better and who are searching for moral order. No. They are middle class, many of them highly educated, and they are searching for something because something has happened to them.
All right.
Which is, I think, a different way of looking at it.
What do you think Amy Semple McPherson would say? How would she react if she came back today and could see the Foursquare Church, the International Foursquare Gospel Church, or if she could walk into your Foursquare Church in Pasadena?
Yeah. She would like my church.
Okay.
I think it represents what she wanted. I won't put that positive spin on it. I mean, I don't want to be that self-aggrandizing. She would like it because it's multicultural and multiracial, and it appears to be very much in keeping with what she wanted Foursquare to be, missions-oriented and diverse. It would also be very much, she would also like it probably less so because it doesn't exhibit a lot of social concern. It kind of ran with the
She might be a little disappointed in that.
She might be a little disappointed uh-huh. there. So on the surface, she might like it. Mm-hmm. Globally, I think she'd love Foursquare because it does what she wanted it to do. She wanted, for example, for higher education, she wanted to set up Bible training institutes simply to train ministers. She didn't exhibit a lot of interest in higher education in terms of seminary training. And to this day, Foursquare does not have a liberal arts college. And the reason and to my dismay, quite frankly, but the reason I've heard that is because Sister Amy didn't set it up that way.
Huh.
Well, Sister Amy's gone, you know, but it doesn't really matter that there is still an impetus to make theological training wholly practical, wholly local, and strictly for the training of pastors and ministers and not for any other type of intellectual exercise.
Do you think she would be happier with the social justice element of the global church than the church in Pasadena?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, sadly. And quite frankly, most Foursquare churches in the United States.
Okay.
My church is not unique. My church mirrors greatly what many of the churches that I've visited and seen across the United States when I've had a chance to visit them. She would be much happier with the global outreach, with the emphasis on healing, and with the emphasis on social concern.
Mm-hmm.
So I think globally, her movement is doing fine.
Okay. Well, I think this is great. I think we've covered everything we needed to cover. Is there anything else you want to say? I mean, I had other questions, but it was a great conversation. Is there anything we haven't talked about that's important to you?
I would just like to mention, we didn't too much, is part of the reason why I think Amy was so vilified was this kind of subtext of sexuality.
Okay.
And also how that is played out today in terms of women in ministry. Single women in ministry, extremely difficult to find single women who pastor. Women have to be attached, as it were. They have to be married. So the whole kind of aura of sexuality is tempered and kind of placed in this proper context of marriage. But Amy, who was, what, divorced twice?
Yeah, and, you know, widowed once.
She had, yeah, very, very, very messy. Mm-hmm. Very, very messy stuff. And who was honest about her marital problems. And who was honest about being lonely. And who, you know, would often talk about in public, talk about, well, how she really wanted a mate. That just kind of set off a lot of bells, a lot of alarm bells going, you know, this is not good. Mm-hmm. She didn't exude this overt sexuality, but just essentially this, the sense of being a woman.
Oh,
and
she was
a single
glamorous.
Woman.
She was beautiful.
She was, mm-hmm. she was Hollywood. Mm-hmm. You know, she was a star. Mm-hmm. And so you can, you know, that was meant for women who were secular, who were kind of lost in the world. This was not meant for a founder of a movement, you know. And so she shouldn't be lonely. She shouldn't have wanted to have male companionship. She should have been content, I guess, to run a movement and to be quiet, yeah. Right? So, I mean, that's something that I hear that a lot resonating with single women today struggling in ministry, because I work at a seminary. So it's single women today trying desperately to get married, you know,
right.
So they can have some kind of legitimacy.
Right.
And I don't think Amy was the first, certainly, but I think that whole stamp of, again, this, it's emblematic of the problems that single women have or divorced women have in Pentecostal denominations, where they're, because of their perceived failings or lack of suitability for some reason, has made them less capable of fulfilling their call. So that's something we didn't talk about, but I mean, I'd certainly like to just chime in on that.
Okay. And as you know, we have the website, and it's kind of a multifaceted presentation. It's what's on the
sure.
radio, what's on the web. And so this is great to talk to you again.
Great to talk to you. I appreciate it.
Blessings on your baby.
And, thank you.
Colleen, I'm sure, and you will email, and you'll know what's happening with all this. And if we have some more questions, we'll send them by email as well.
I would love it. This is really great. I'm pleased to make a return appearance.
Great. Well, thank you so
Thanks
much.
A lot.
Yeah. Bye-bye.
Okay, bye-bye, Krista.